I'm calling to order the meeting of this meeting of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division. We will start by having the clerk take the roll.
Representative Pinto?
Present.
Representative Katiza Watoon, Vice Chair. Representative Franson is excused. Representative Bonner? Representative Damath?
Present.
Representative Heinzman?
I'm here.
Representative Morrison? Representative Pryor?
Present.
Representative Wasilek?
Present.
Representative West is excused.
Okay, thank you. We're going to be hearing some bills on child care licensing and regulation. We're still getting ourselves in order, but I know Representative Heinzman wanted to start with a statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really appreciate that. I just need to get some comments on the record.
So absolutely.
Let me run through that. At our previous meeting, that was Thursday, March 14th, Rep. Franson made a motion, and it was for this division to request that the Committee of Ways and Means issue a subpoena for the OIG Inspector General, Carolyn Hamm, to appear before this division Thursday, March 21st. And under your authority as chair, this is your job, so I appreciate your and I respect your authority. You ruled that the motion was out of order. Well, I disagree with that ruling. I thank you for the deliberate nature in how you considered the motion rather than simply disregarding the motion. Appreciate that very much. And then gaveling adjournment. I also want to include for the record my objection to your failing to recognize a member's right to challenge ruling in a chair. That was mine. You give our committee chairs wide latitude to conduct the necessary business of the House, your authority is not absolute or above challenge. The same rights reserved to members on the floor to appealing a ruling of the presiding officer apply to members of the committee. I would also wish to concur with Rep. Franson that you share a genuine interest to find the truth and to do what is best for the parents and children relying on these programs. I believe you come to your position as chair with a good heart and in good faith. With that said, it remains frustrating for some members of this committee that we have not yet exercised our oversight authority relating to child care fraud. Today we are holding our 17th meeting, during which we'll have had 10 meetings dedicated to or including presentations. And none of these meetings have we heard from the Office of the Inspector General or anyone dealing with child care assistance fraud. I will remain We had an initial overview of the Governor's CAP recommendations, and the department came fully unprepared to answer any questions relating to the efforts to counter fraud. Over the next couple weeks, as we rapidly approach deadlines, this division will have to make some important decisions regarding program policy and funding. That is the urgency in getting the information we need. Thank you for the time, Mr. Chair.
And thank you, Representative Heinzman. Thanks for noting that. And we will make sure, so we're finalizing the minutes, and we'll make sure that they reflect what happened on Thursday. And I appreciate your recognition of the interest, I think, of all the members, certainly, to pursue both the truth and also integrity in the program, making sure that tax dollars are being spent well and that families are getting the support that they need. I want to make sure to note that there was this was a motion for a request for another for a committee, a parent committee several levels up to subpoena an individual. There actually was then a motion made the following day on Friday in a different committee where that motion was voted down. It was considered on the merits in that committee because it was actually presented to that committee. But we'll continue to have discussions. And I suppose one other thing I should note is that today might have been a day when we would have been considering program integrity proposals. The lead, Representative Franson, is out of town for these couple days, and I had reached out to her in advance to find out if there were topics that she wanted to make sure would be covered when she was around. I had to guess that program integrity might be one of those topics, would be my guess, but I wanted to ask her, and she confirmed that. So on Thursday, we will be hearing a number of proposals relating to CCAP program integrity, but one of the reasons we wouldn't be doing that today or tomorrow is that Representative Franson is out of town and that it was important to her to get to be around. So anyway, thank you again. Representative Heinzman, pardon me, you have a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
No, I want to believe that we're probably hearing the same thing from constituents. Folks want to absolutely get to the bottom of this. And this committee, I think, is well-suited to working on having some of those hard conversations. I think we can do it in a respectful way, and I think it'd be really important to bring in some of the key players in this. It is incredibly frustrating when we do have representatives from agencies here, and they absolutely have no answers, and the public is literally losing their mind. They want some answers, and I think that the majority and the minority want to get to those answers, and it would just be really nice if that process could start sooner than later.
Thank you, Representative. And so again, I know that on Thursday, the first day, Representative Franson is back. We will be considering a number of proposals at that point in response to the report. And then we know there's a second report that is, in fact, being prepared now by the legislative auditor regarding the processes inside the department relating to CCAP, et cetera. So clearly an ongoing conversation. But thank you again. And Representative Franson, you have another follow-up, it sounds like.
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This would be the final comment. Are we going to get to somebody or get a chance to talk to somebody like Carolyn Hamm? Or are there going to be others from an agency that actually will potentially be in a position to answer the questions that this committee has?
So, Representative Hanson, when we hear the we're going to be hearing proposals on Thursday relating to program integrity, a number of which are supported by the department. Regardless, we'll have folks from the department who'll be there, and I would think that that would be an excellent opportunity to ask questions. That's going to be the topic, right, for a number of those bills, a number of those proposals. And so I would certainly expect that that'd be an opportunity to be asking any questions that you have or that others have relating to this topic. So thank you. Okay, so we have a number of bills to get through today, and part of what's going on here, too, I should note, members, is that we're going to have a pretty jam-packed week getting through a number of bills and proposals. So I'd like to have Representative Wasilewicz head of the testifiers table. We do have a quorum, and so we will have her move House File 1685 for possible inclusion in a division report. Representative Wasilewicz, we'll have you make that motion, and it appears that you have an amendment, a delete all authors amendment. Do you wish to move that amendment, Representative Wasilewicz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would move the DE1 amendment.
Okay, and this will put the bill in the form that the author wishes. Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. House File 1685 is in the form that the author wishes, and so, Representative Wasilewicz, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Under current rules, a licensed family daycare or group family daycare provider may use a substitute caregiver for up to 30 days in a 12-month period. This bill, as amended, would allow for the use of a substitute caregiver for up to 300 hours in a year and would allow the commissioner to grant variances to that limit. One of the reasons for this, the amendment, is that in a lot of cases, caregivers are not taking full days off, and so they may take a couple of hours in a day to go to an appointment or to take care of something with their family. And what was happening was they would count that as a full day. So this is an attempt to try to allow some greater flexibility by allowing providers to count hours instead of entire days at once. And then also providing some variances in case you have long-term absence, such as somebody being in the hospital for medical treatment, cancer treatment, any sort of reason, family issues, why they would be out for a longer period of time. It allows DHS to provide a variance in those cases.
Thank you, Representative Wasilewicz. And do you have any testifiers, Representative Wasilewicz?
Nope.
You do not? Okay. And anyone who wishes to testify, I see Ms. Seidel coming down, so we'll have her go first. If there's anybody else, we'll have them come up after. And so, Ms. Seidel, if you can identify yourself for the record, and then please provide your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman and committee members, for hearing my testimony today. My name is Julie Seidel, and I'm the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Association of Child Care Professionals, and I've been a licensed child care provider in Anoka County. I want to give you a little bit of background here. In September of 2018, we officially fell below 8,000 child care providers to 7,955 licensed family child care providers. As of yesterday, we have lost another 98 providers, and we're down to 7,857. This is still an average of 1 to 2 licensed family child care providers who are closing their doors daily, proving these reforms are desperately needed. We have now lost approximately another 1,000 child care slots in the state of Minnesota. Today you will be hearing several bills that are the beginning to much-needed reform for licensed family child care providers. Although some of these bills seem small in content, the impact for providers will be great. Today, you'll also be hearing amendments that DHS has been allowed to bring forward late in the session without any discussion or input by stakeholders. The department has had knowledge of these bills for weeks and has even had long discussions with bill authors, but has waited until now to make their disapproval known. Today is yet another demonstration of how the department is not willing to work with providers in a transparent, open, and meaningful manner. You, the lawmakers, are the only ones that can force DHS into this kind of relationship with child care. If DHS continues to get what they want, when they want, and are allowed to give their technical assistance that either changes the complete intent of the bill or squashes it altogether, they will never come to the table with providers in a meaningful way. House File 1685, we are asking to expand the days we use substitute cares in our home. We would like to see a minimum of 60 days. This would allow providers to take a decent maternity leave to care for their newborn child, to care for an ailing family member, or seek medical treatment for themselves. By allowing a substitute for up to 60 days, it would keep families from scrambling for backup child care, which is nearly impossible due to the child care crisis. It would keep continuity in care of the children enrolled and preserve the provider's business during life-changing events. DHS is asking for an amendment here to allow for only 300 hours of a substitute, which equates to less than 30 days, as the majority of providers work 11 to 12 hours per day. At a minimum, providers should be given the equivalent of 60 days or 400 hours to use a substitute caregiver. After 30 days, DHS is basically going to be the ones to determine whether they feel what is happening in our lives is worthy of a variance, and I find that very demeaning. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Seidel. Ms. Seidel, maybe I can just ask, is and so you're, what you're asking for, your preference would be to have a greater number of hours than the 300 that's listed in the total number of hours in the calendar year is a concern. I just want to make sure I understand.
Correct.
What you're saying.
Correct. Okay. 30 days is just not enough time. For myself personally, I use up about half of those days here while I'm at the Capitol trying to deal with the situation we have ongoing. If something was to happen to myself or my family, I would have to shut down my daycare after 2 weeks and then go to DHS and basically beg for them to give me a variance to keep my child care open. That would be a huge disruption for my families, for the children in my care, and, to be honest, for me financially.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you, and thanks for sharing your perspective. Thank you. We have another testifier, looks like. And please identify yourself for the record, and then please proceed.
My name is... Oh, there she is.
Oh.
I'm Kim Leopold for the Association of Minnesota Family Child Care Licensors.
May need some help. May need some help with that. Okay.
I'm loud, so.
Okay, we're gonna. I'll tell you what. Give it just a second. We'll see if we can get it fixed. Because we want to make sure.
We can switch spots.
Let's see if maybe while that's being fixed, we want to make sure you get on the mic in part so you get recorded.
Thank you.
Okay.
Chairman and members of the committee, the Association of Minnesota Family Child Care Licensors does not have a problem with extending the amount of hours for providers to have substitutes. The clarity I'm hoping, and it's just in statute anyway, is that that's per provider, not per substitute. I know that there has been sometimes some confusion with that. The other thing is I do agree with Ms. Seidel. I don't understand why DHS would be the ones to make approve a variance. Currently, the counties are all designated to make to do variances on everything. We don't have to put anything forth to DHS, so I'm not sure why that would change in this one, and so we are definitely against DHS having to approve a variance for extra time if that's needed.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else wishes to testify from the public? I wonder Mr. Zempel, could you maybe just provide any input from the department regarding that, some of the points that were made by Ms. Seidel, Ms. Leopold? I guess any comments, regarding the bill, if there's any comment that you have in response to those concerns that were expressed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Chris Zempel, Department of Human Services. We do not have our licensing policy staff here today.
Okay.
Would like to go back and talk with them about about the genesis of the 300 hours.
Okay.
And to see if they'd be open to the feedback from the testifiers.
Okay, we definitely would want to get that input.
Absolutely.
So, okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. And then, yes, yeah, so again, anybody else from the public wish to testify? Doesn't look like it. So member questions then, if there are any. And not seeing any. Not seeing any. Okay. Representative Wazlow will give you the final word on this bill at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to say I think that this is giving some flexibility, so I like the idea of sticking with the hours, I think, is a good idea. If we need to consider maybe expanding that amount of hours, I'm certainly open to that discussion.
Okay. So in the meantime, this is simply being laid over for possible inclusion in a division report, and so, yeah, I think it does make sense to have those continued conversations. Thank you, Representative Wazlowick. And then with that, we will have Representative Pryor head on up, and there's a number of bills that she has. And I think Representative Pryor will probably just go in the order on the agenda here, which is in a numerical order. And so starting off with House File 19. You know what? I better just clarify that Pryor bill is laid over as amended, the Wazlowick bill, House File 1685 for possible inclusion. So House File 1924, Representative Pryor moves that bill for possible inclusion as well. Representative Pryor, let's see if you've got an amendment, and you do, and do you wish to offer that amendment, Representative Pryor?
Yes, I'd like to offer that amendment, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay, that's the A1. And this is.
I'm sorry, I'm going to pick up
home. Oh, fair enough.
Sorry.
Yeah, helpful to have that whole packet. So Representative Pryor moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that she prefers as the author. Any discussion on the A1? And seeing none, all in favor of approval of the A1, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Opposed.
Okay. So then House File 1924 is in the form the author wishes. And so Representative Pryor, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this bill does a couple different things in terms of licensing. One is that it makes a change that the provider does not have to send provide notice to all of the parents in the families in the child care about the emergency preparedness plan. Let's see. That they post the emergency plans or share them with parents of the children they serve, and that there were safety concerns around this. Then there's also a second part of this, which it provides. It also specifically includes infants and toddlers. And this is one of the things that we need to do to comply with the federal child care development block grant. And there is public notification of the need to comply with this federal requirement, and in fact there are penalties for not complying. So this is something that's in this bill. It will also be in the governor's bill, so we can adapt it here, or it'll be proposed again in the governor's bill, because it is needed to for this compliance.
Okay. Any testifiers?
And then, I'm sorry, the original bill just was dealing with home care settings, and this is also including licensed setting care centers and also licensed exempt care settings that need to comply with this too. So it's just kind of following the language that's going to be in the governor's bill, and it's including all of those, because all of those have to now comply, include infant toddlers in their plan.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Pryor. Do you have any testifiers?
No.
Okay. Members of the public, Ms. Seidel, come on down. And just confirm yourself for the record, and then please provide your testimony.
Julie Seidel, Public Policy Director for MACCP. The emergency plan is removing the requirement to give that copy to the parents, and the reason we're asking for this is, imagine after 17 years of child care handing that out to parents, how many people would actually have that. Inside of an emergency plan also includes our lockdown procedures. In our homes, we have very few places to hide, so we do not want anyone to be aware of where we're hiding, unless, of course, they're law enforcement. The one question I do have with the amendment that's been offered is I would like to know where in the child care development block grant it says that we have to have specifics on infants and toddlers. This is not a conversation, again, that DHS has had with providers. It would be nice for us to know. We have been duped in the past, being told things are a requirement of the block grant, such as fingerprinting on minor children. And without that question and having the actual answer, I'm not comfortable with adding that language. I understand it's not my choice, but I think that DHS should have to show in writing proof where it says that we need to add infant and toddlers into their not every provider has infants and toddlers in their care, so it wouldn't be a process for somebody to do when it's not going to affect them. So if we could ask DHS where that is, where we can locate it within the block grant, I would appreciate that.
Ms., I want to make sure I'm understanding. So your thought is that, like on lines 1.19 and lines 2.18 in the amendment, just for convenience, that the addition of you're saying that the reason to add infants and toddlers, that you want to know kind of what the requirement is coming from to say that we have to have infants and toddlers, because if we have to include that because if a provider doesn't care for infants and toddlers, this shouldn't be imposed.
Correct.
I do wonder, though, as we're looking at this, that, I mean, if a provider doesn't care for infants and toddlers, then presumably the accommodation for infants and toddlers would be, you know, not applicable. It doesn't, you know, maybe that's naive, I guess. Is that correct to say?
Well, unfortunately, when you go through this emergency preparedness plan that was put together by DHS, mm-hmm. We went through the statute of what needs to be in there, and it was literally 2.5 pages. The emergency preparedness plan by DHS is over 6 pages long, so they're adding things into the emergency preparedness plan which are not required and making it quite a lengthy process. So that's why we question any time they want to add something else to that emergency preparedness plan. Why are we adding it, and is it an actual requirement by the CCDBG?
Okay, good. Good. Thank you so much. Thank you. Anyone else who wishes to testify for or against the bill? Okay. And let me think on the member questions. It does seem like Ms. Seidel's question is a good one to be getting answered before this would be possibly included. I do see Mr. Zempel raising his hand, so yeah, please come on down. Please identify yourself again, and then sure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Chris Zempel with DHS. The citation is 45 CFR 98.41A1. We can definitely provide Ms. Seidel with a copy of the language. It reads, emergency preparedness and response planning for emergencies resulting from a natural disaster or man-caused event, such as violence at a child care facility, within the meaning of those terms under Section 602A1 of the Robert T. Stafford Disaster Relief and Emergency Assistance Act, that shall include procedures for evacuation, relocation, shelter in place, and lockdown. Staff and volunteer emergency preparedness training and practice drills, communication and reunification with families.
Mr. Zempel, I'm going to maybe stop you just because we can look that up. I guess the question is, and thank you for providing the citation, is there a reference in there, and you may not know this right now, I'm not sure how long it is, but is there a reference in there specifically to the need to include, to reference infants and toddlers?
Mr. Chair, yes, that was the next.
Okay, so the part you were about to say, my apologies. Okay, well, in any case, then I hope Ms. Adele or anybody else got down the number and then can take a look themselves, and then if there are concerns, I'm looking back at Ms. Seidel to reach back on out, but thank you for providing that citation that we can take a look at that and see and provide an assessment of that. But thank you so much for sharing that.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
That's helpful. Good. Any other questions from members? And not seeing any, Representative Pryor will give you the final word then on House File 1924.
I move that it be laid over for possible
okay.
As amended.
Thank you, and with that, I will do that. And thank you very much, Representative Pryor. We are moving to House File 1925 then, and this Representative Pryor moves for possible inclusion. No amendment on this one, and Representative Pryor to your bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So this, we wanted to take a look at a couple aspects of this that, wait a minute, I got to make sure I'm on the right bill. All right, 1925.
Here's the bill.
All right, this 1925, it's really addressing the exit interview, and that by removing the language that it does from this bill, it has the force of saying that when an exit interview is concluded, everything that will be cited in as a negative action, a correction order, a negative action, anything that would be cited in that area would have been discussed in the exit interview.
And I think there was a prior that I think Ms. Seidel may be able to help you give in terms of describing the need for the bill as well. I know that she provides some testimony in the other body as well. But I'll let you finish, but we'll have her come down as well. So if there's anything more you want to add, Representative Breyer.
No, I think that's the force of what we're trying to do here, and I know that we can talk about the importance of doing this and the impact on the providers.
Thank you. So, Ms. Seidel, if you could just confirm your identity and then for this bill, and then proceed.
Julie Seidel, MACCP. After a license visit, the county licensor is required to sit down with a provider and go over the results of the inspection. At the time, a provider should be told of any possible correction orders that will be written. It is imperative that a provider have that information so they are able to gather any documentation they may need to help substantiate their position if they choose to ask for reconsideration.
Pardon me? Oh.
I thought I heard, sorry. Oh.
Please continue.
You know, and here's a good example that you might be able to understand. Just imagine if you were pulled over by a police officer and he didn't give you a ticket at the time. I'm sure that you would be relieved as you feel that you had not broken any laws. Now imagine receiving a ticket in the mail weeks to months afterwards. Would you remember where you were, what you were doing, were you even driving the car, and how would you defend yourself if it came down to a court of law? Last week in the Senate, DHS was asked if they had a problem with this language, and at the time that they said they were neutral, I did see that they have offered up some amendments here, that they have concerns about losing the ability to issue a correction order or negative action for violations that were not discussed in an exit interview, especially in cases which the license holder needs to end the exit interview before all violations are reviewed. An exit interview really shouldn't take more than a few minutes of time during a licensing inspection, so I'm not understanding the worry that a license holder would need to end the exit interview before all discussions happen. If a provider needs to tend to a child during the interview or the licensing inspection, the licensors will have to be patient and wait until the provider can return to finish the conversation. There needs to be an understanding that depending on the time of day a licensor shows up and the length of time they spend on an inspection, children will need our attention. There will be times we need to change diapers, prep meals, and serve meals or console a child. This is something the vast majority of county licensors understand. The biggest concern here is that during that last Senate hearing, DHS did not have any problem with the language, and now today here in the House they have a problem. I really don't know what to say about this. I feel we have the right to defend ourselves. We should have the right to be able to collect that information at the time we're told of a correction order, not to try and scramble 3 to 4 months later to remember what we were doing, what children were in the home, what activities were taking place in order to collect that information.
And Ms. Adele, I just want to clarify, I'm not aware of amendments having been offered. Maybe I'm misunderstanding something. Are there amendments?
There's no amendment in this one. Okay, because that's what came through last night was the amendment. And there's also an amendment in the Senate that I was emailed this weekend for amending this bill.
I don't know about the amendment in the Senate, about anything in the
right.
Senate. I'm not aware of an amendment having been offered on this bill.
Right. Okay, I apologize. I thought she was offering up the amendment. I apologize.
No problem. I guess as long as you brought it up. I understand that that an exit interview typically be pretty quick. I suppose I could imagine a situation, right, and understand you got a lawyer and a prosecutor here, so sorry, because I kind of come at things from a particular angle. You know, the exit interview starts, and then, you know, whatever, there's a spill in the next room, or there's something that happens, right, and then it gets cut off, and then sort of that's the end of it. They never get back to it, right? So it lasted 2 minutes, and it could have lasted 10. I mean, you could imagine that situation, right? I'm just trying to think about how that works, whether there's some way to work that, because otherwise sort of the way this is written is that once the interview starts, at that point, nothing can be brought up, even if you've got, at least as I read this, if you've got a safety issue or something. So I'm just trying to understand it.
Maybe we should speak to Kim Leopold about that too, because she knows how the accident interviews go.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't be the case if I have to go change a poopy diaper. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be okay. We're done with the interview. Kim would sit and she would wait for us to take care of the child, and then.
let Ms. Seidel finish, and then Ms. Leopold can come up,
and then come back and finish the exit interview. It wouldn't. I don't see a scenario where a provider would decide to say, "I'm done with this. Leave." At that point, I could understand it, but we're talking about just normal everyday activities where we may have to interrupt that exit interview, come back to it, and finish it. Mm-hmm. If a provider chooses not to participate in that exit interview, that language is in this bill,
right,
that then it's basically fair game at that point. But okay. We have to, when we're trying to do the best that we can, we have to be told up front. And even if the licensor says, I'm not sure about this one, I'm going to go back to the office, discuss it, with other licensors, we'll get back to you, at least we have a heads up that that is coming.
Mm-hmm.
And that we can, collect our thoughts, collect pictures, whatever we need to, in order to give our side of that story.
Sure. Thank you. That's really helpful. And Ms. Leopold, you please come on up and provide your perspective.
No. I've done enough.
Please identify yourself and
Chairman and members of the committee. I am Kim Leopold, Legislative Committee on the Association of Minnesota Family Child Care Licensors. Again, with agreeing with Ms. Seidel, as a licensing worker, these things should be discussed. Again, we are in the business of keeping children safe. So if as a licensing worker, if I'm walking through a home and I see something of concern, I'm mentioning it anyway. In the county that I work in, we actually have a piece of paper that's carbon copy that we have exit interview across the top. We write down the things that we have concerns about, or not, or played a great game with the kids today, or whatever it may be. I think, yes, we sometimes will see something and need to discuss it with our supervisors, with our co-workers, with sometimes DHS. So again, though, it might be a county issue or an individual licensor issue that these things are not being discussed with providers, and I think that's where this exit interview comes from, and that again is a supervisory issue in individual counties. Licensing workers should be discussing with providers what they see, because again, the bottom line is safety for children, and if I see something alarming, I'm not going to leave and write a correction order 5 days later.
Right.
And yes, as Ms. Seidel said, we may leave even and just call you at nap time or however it works. We realize that we are coming into homes where business is being operated and children are being cared for, and yes, if there's a diaper or lunch, I mean, it doesn't matter. We will be respectful of the provider and the children's time.
And so, Ms. Leopold, so it sounds like, in general, you feel like this could, you sound supportive. I guess I want to make sure that I'm...
But I think, again, the issue might be individual licensing workers. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can only speak for myself and the people that I work with and the people that I know and the state who contacts me, the workers in the state who contact us. If a provider is not being talked to about what's going on in their home, that's the problem. So, yeah, I mean, I support this because then we will have to talk to providers.
Yeah, and of course, we're passing laws of general applicability, right? So we want to make sure we're setting a standard and then expecting folks to follow. So, good. Thank you so much. Thanks for your input on that. Anyone else from the public who wishes to testify for or against the bill? And so not seeing any, questions from members? And Representative Cotizzi-Witun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this actually may be a question for Ms. Leopold. I apologize. You've already returned to your seat. I was going to ask, actually, before you mentioned the carbon copy situation, if there was a leave behind for providers in the case the meeting does get interrupted, the exit interview gets interrupted and truncated, that they have something to review in the licensor's absence to follow up with any questions, Is that something that is decided at the county level, or is that something that's pretty statewide standard? Everybody gets a leave behind when this type of meeting happens.
It is.
Ms. Leopold.
Sorry. Chair, members of the committee, it is decided at the county level. Ms. Seidel could speak to your county. I'm not sure. I know that in our county, that is what we do.
Okay.
We could call up Ms. Seidel to answer before that, or if that kind of satisfies you, Representative Cazese, we can.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would be curious how many counties across the state of Minnesota have something in process like that for the providers to have on hand.
And if somebody in general can answer that, but then certainly Ms. Seidel, if you have information about your own county and wish to comment on this, please do.
Chairman, yes, I'm licensed in Anoka County, and they've had for 17 years what they call a memo where things are written down and handed to us so that we have it clearly written out. This is what has transpired. This is what you need to fix. That's been something they've offered for 17 years. Some other counties don't do that. It depends on the licensor and it depends on the county, but I would believe a large majority of counties are doing it. What we're trying to do is stop the counties and the licensors that are not doing it, because that has become a real problem across certain areas.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Good.
Appreciate that.
Thank you. Any other member questions? And not seeing any, then we will, then I will, actually, I'm sorry, I should let Representative Pryor get the last word on this bill. Any final comment you have?
I just would like to move House File 1925 without amendments be laid over.
Okay. And I will do so, Representative Pryor, and so we will then move to your next bill, House File 1926. And Representative Pryor moves that bill for possible inclusion in the division report. You do have a delete all amendment, Representative Pryor, an author's amendment. Do you wish to move that amendment?
Yes, I would like to move that amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Any discussion on that? And seeing none, all in favor of approving the author's amendment to get the bill in the form that she wishes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the bill is amended and Representative Pryor to House File 1926.
All right. So in this bill, we are looking at a couple different things, and one of it is about certain people that would be in the household that are exempt from training and background studies, and then also the third section of this is about emergency plans or if the provider has to, in an emergency, leave their facility, their child care home. So the first is language about not certain people that might be taking care of their own child in the household do not have to be trained. And then the second part about very narrow scope of situations where the provider would have to leave the children in the daycare with someone that has not been trained. And so this is working with federal requirements about what they will allow or not allow. So it's very narrowly carved out a situation where children would be left with someone that has not had a background check and someone that has not been trained. And basically the situation is describing where in an emergency, an illness, the home needs to be, the children need to go home, the home needs to be shut down, but an adult needs to stay there until all the children can be picked up. And so in general, that's the kind of situation that this language is trying to permit and say, you know, under these extraordinary circumstances, this is what the provider can do. And I will let Ms. Seidel be a testifier on this if she will permit and talk about more about the situation. Yep. And also, I think, you know, there's ways that we could, you know, keep looking at this language.
Yeah.
And improving it.
Okay, well, we'll turn then to Ms. Seidel. So, Ms. Seidel, please confirm your identity and proceed.
Julie Seidel, MACCP. On House File 1926, as Representative Pryor stated, this is tackling two problems. The first is an issue where we are having visiting family members are being told that they have to have training because they're there during daycare hours when they're watching our own children, their grandchildren, nieces and nephews. And we've even had farm families that were being told their children are not allowed to do chores with the other parent during daycare hours because the parent does not have training and the ALT buildings are not licensed for child care. So this becomes a great problem. When family members want to visit with their children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, they should not be required to have a background study and have 16 hours of training. The provider does not allow these family members to have unsupervised contact or provide direct care to daycare children. Our children should not be denied the right to spend time with family because one of their parents is a child care provider. The second issue is the emergency substitute. DHS had actually announced at a stakeholder meeting in January that we would no longer be allowed to use an emergency substitute of any kind. Providers were told this is a requirement of the Child Care Development Block Grant. After doing a lot of research and then reaching out to the Office of Child Care in Washington, D.C., I received an email and a phone call from Maria Pestilardo from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in Chicago. And as she explained it to me, this would be left up to the individual states to carve out that particular situation for providers. After this information came to light, DHS has decided that they found a way to allow providers to use an emergency replacement. We do appreciate that, but we do have a couple of issues with the technical assistance on the language. The first one is that the provider would be required, if practicable, to try and locate a qualified substitute. Who is determining what is practicable? What if the provider felt time was of the essence to call the nearest safe person to care for the children until the parents picked up, but DHS felt that we had time to make several phone calls? How could we prove we made a practicable effort? Number two is there is also a requirement that we have the emergency replacement sign a statement, if not before, within 7 days of the emergency sent to our county licensors and then forwarded to DHS. What if the provider is still hospitalized or out of state caring for a family member? At most, a provider should only be required to inform their licensor during that licensing year. Subjecting that to 7 days would open us up for more correction orders and actions against us. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Anyone else who wishes to testify for or against the bill? Ms. Leopold. And just confirm yourself for the record and then please proceed.
Kim Leopold, Legislative Committee of the Association of Minnesota Family Child Care Licensors. We're in agreement with some of it, but have questions and concerns about other parts of it. Currently in the rule, it states that providers' own children count in the numbers and are afforded the same protections as enrolled children. Since a relative is not a part of the program, if they're not going to be a part of the program and they take the child somewhere else and they believe in spanking, since they're not a part of the program, is that going to be a perceived threat to the children enrolled? Is that it gets blurry. We see blurs with this all the time anyway. In the first part, section one, it talks about license holder's own child. A helper, the definition of a helper is between the ages of 13 and 18. I think we take issue with a 13 to 18-year-old supervising a child care age child elsewhere in the home. I don't think there's as much of an issue if it was an adult, but 13 to 18 years old in another area of the home. Again, if something were to happen to that child somewhere else, what would that look like to, unfortunately, DHS, but also insurance, the other children? Would the provider need to leave the area to go tend to that child, then leaving, you know, other children potentially uncared for? Again, with total numbers allowed, making sure that that's 300 or 400, whatever that new one becomes, is per provider. Parents are our clients, customers, and I think if this is going to go through and if this is something that is just going to happen, I do believe that the parents should know that this is happening, not necessarily that they need to know who's in the home, but that there may be people in the home that do not have a background study, that do not have training in regards to relatives coming and caring for children. We are not saying that grandparents cannot come and visit their children in the home. We are not saying that aunts and uncles and cousins and things like that cannot visit their children, grandchildren in the home. Providers have chosen this as a profession, and there are laws and rules that when you choose this that need to be followed for the safety of all children. I personally couldn't imagine going in and seeing someone I didn't know in the program, and I think of a center. I used to work in Centerland, and my mom and my, you know, my family could not come and visit me there while I was working in the preschool classroom that I was in. Well, as far as the emergency the emergency replacement caregiver, we think that is all okay. I think we've seen it where, you know, the providers will designate someone and it's a neighbor or their partner or husband or whatever, and they're not around. And they need to get to the hospital with an enrolled child or with their own child or for themselves. I think it's completely appropriate that it allows for a little bit of wiggle room on that. The only issue, as Ms. Seidel stated, I don't understand why the county agencies would need to submit this statement to the commissioner within 3 business days. We currently, again, do not have to submit certain things to the commissioner within any business days regarding some of these things. These things happen at the county level. Mm. We take care of it. We handle it appropriately, we think. Not always, of course. That's our thoughts on it.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Anyone else from the public wishes to testify for or against the bill? And seeing none, member questions, if any. Representative Gutierrez-Witun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up on the 7 calendar days comment. Would there be anything, Representative Pryor or potentially Ms. Leopold, I'm not sure who would be able to speak to this best, if they were still, the provider was still in the hospital or out of state or, you know, some truly emergency situation that is lasting longer than those 7 business days, is there anything that would allow for an extension?
Representative Pryor, if you know.
Well, the language does say to the extent practical. So, I mean, I think that's what the exception is that if it's not something that can be accomplished, if the provider themselves is hospitalized, then it's not going to happen.
Thank you. Just wanted to make sure.
Okay. Any other questions, members? That's strange. The microphones are really acting funny today.
Sorry.
I want to make sure to note, Ms. Seidel and Ms. Leopold, to certainly be in touch with Representative Pryor, I suppose Representative Wozlewick on the first bill, too, as mm-hmm. these bills are being laid over, and it seems like there's certainly some looking to be done on the language. And you've raised conceptual points and then actually connecting with the authors in terms of kind of what language might actually meet some of your concerns or address some of your concerns. We should please be in touch with the authors to do that. So thank you. Okay, so Representative Pryor, I'll give you any final comment you wish to make. If any?
I move that it be laid over.
Okay, and I'm...
as amended.
And House File 1926 is laid over as amended for possible inclusion. And then House File 2047, Representative Pryor does move that bill for possible inclusion in a division report as well. There do not appear to be any amendments. And so, Representative Pryor to House File 2047.
This bill 2047 just makes it very clear that when a county licensor is required, that it makes sure that the county licensor is required to seek clarification from the Department of Human Services before a correction order is issued if there's a dispute.
Okay. A short bill, and then comments. So, Ms. Seidel, please provide your testimony. Identify yourself. Provide your testimony on this bill as well.
Julie Seidel, MACCP. This is something that providers are very excited about. What it would do is it would give providers the chance to be part of the process with DHS, that we would be able to email DHS along with the county licensor. The county licensor can explain their side of the story, we'll call it, and then the provider would be able to give their side of the story to make a determination. This is really going to end up saving time and money for DHS because it will stop any erroneous correction orders if it is a licensor who is misinterpreting the rule, and it will also give the provider clarification that, yes, you were in violation, this is a valid correction order, so it would stop that reconsideration process, which takes extensive amounts of time, and if it's an erroneous correction order, that correction order stays on the website for up to 3, 4, or 5 months until the reconsideration process is over with. So it would stop that from being put on the website, having to be taken down, and then for DHS to have their lawyers involved to look at these reconsiderations. So doing this up on the front end would really save time and money for DHS also.
Thank you. Thank you for that testimony. Ms. Leopold, did you, looks like you want to come down. I kind of thought that you would, providing the county licensing perspective. So please identify yourself and provide your testimony.
Kim Leopold, Legislative Committee, AMFCCL. The Senate has introduced a tiered correction order system, which I'm not sure if everyone is aware of that. I don't get how it all works, so I don't know. So that would alleviate the need for this. That I've been working with them at the Senate about this system, and it's very clearly laid out. There's 1 through 4. They would be working with license holders, hopefully, and licensing workers about what would be considered 1 through, you know, the most severe and things like that. Also, sometimes I do agree with someone who just said if there are disputes, I think Ms. Seidel said that. I think there are very clear violations that I am hoping that if this goes through, that we would not have to go back and discuss with DHS. The other thing, this seems to be a bit of a contradiction to House File 1925, where we can't leave the House without talking to them about what the violations are. Mm-hmm. But then we're expected to go back and talk to DHS about it. So I think I do know that there are discrepancies in licensing workers and they overstep the rules and the laws. I'm hoping that the tiered system, again, would alleviate the need for this.
Thank you, Ms. Leopold. As long as we're moving through the bills pretty quickly and we have Ms. Seidel here, I wonder if she has a comment on the tiered correction order system. That's not, since you've raised that as being an alternative way to achieve this, and it's being laid over anyway, I guess I at least am wanting to make sure I'm understanding the different pieces. So, Ms. Seidel, can you just provide a comment on that? I gather that is moving in a separate bill in the Senate, apparently. So, Ms. Seidel, if you can just provide any comment that you have about that as an alternative to this.
Providers are optimistic about it. In theory, it looks like it's a very good system. We would get away from giving correction orders for things that are not, you know, imminent risk to children. Our main concern is that DHS wants complete control over that changeover, and we need to have a say in that. Parents need to have a say. Providers need to have a say. County licensors need to have a say. So our concern right now is that some of the language that is going through is giving DHS total control over changing that system, and that's a great concern to providers because it will be how it's implemented. Like I said, in theory, it looks really good, but when it comes to implementing it, Colorado implemented it a few years ago, and what they did was it's just different levels, 5 different levels of correction orders, and those levels give you certain amount of days to fix the correction order. It didn't do them any good. It didn't give them any relief. They're given correction orders for absolutely everything, things that are not, you know, imminent danger to children. So it's all going to be in the language and how it's actually implemented, and if there's a working group that is able to sit down and to draft this language and get it right the first time and be upfront and honest with everyone.
So maybe an option to explore, because I admit, as I look at this, I do see Ms. Leopold's point that, you know, you hate to have a situation where there's a pretty clear violation, let's say, or requirement, but then the provider simply says, oh, you know, I'm going to dispute this, and it's sort of, you know, you could imagine there being potentially a better way to get at it. And it sounds like you're saying if the language is done right, et cetera, then potentially the tiered licensing or the tiered correction order system could do that potentially.
Correct, and I would hope that a provider wouldn't. When we make mistakes, we need to own up to it and admit to it, and I would certainly hope that the provider wouldn't try and use this to take advantage of the situation. I mean, and like anybody, I'm sure there's somebody out there that would, but for the whole, I'm pretty sure that we can admit when we're wrong and let it go from there.
Yeah.
But there will be that chance, you know, that 1 in a million that somebody is going to try and stand up and cause some trouble to drag their feet, but we can't punish everybody just for that the 1 or 2 that may do that either.
Right. Right. Good. Thank you for that background and that information. Anybody else who wishes to testify from the public for or against? And not seeing anyone. Member questions on House Bill 2047, if any? And not seeing any, then in that case, Representative Pryor, final words on this one? I'm guessing you simply want to renew your motion?
I think this is one where we don't have the final word yet.
Yeah.
It's to be voted over for inclusion.
Thank you. And that may be true for a number of these. Laying this over for possible inclusion and a division report, and moving on to House File 2048. And, again, Representative Pryor moves that bill. She does have a delete all, it appears. Representative Pryor, you wish to move the DE1?
Yes. I'd like to move my amendment, please.
Okay, good. And so this will put the bill in the form that you wish as the author of the bill. Any discussion of that? And seeing none, all in favor of approval of the DE1 amendment to put the bill in the form the author wishes, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. House File 2048 is as you wish, Representative Pryor, and so please describe the bill to us.
All right. So this is it's changing training timelines, and I think I'll turn it over to my testifier. It's changing anniversary dates, and the point behind it is to make it work better for the providers in terms of when they need to renew their different training. But again, you know, it's the details of things, and I think, you know, again, there can be different perspectives on if this is the way to go.
Okay. Well, we'll turn things over to Ms. Seidel, have her testify, if you can identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Julie Seidel, MACCP. What we're trying to accomplish with this bill is back in, it was 2016 or 2017, we changed the requirements from annual to annually for all of our trainings. At the time, we were reinsured by DHS that it would include all of our trainings. When it was implemented, it only came out with trainings that we are required to do on a yearly basis. So there are trainings we have that are required every 2 years or every 5 years. We are being told that if we take car safety or CPR first aid in February of 2017, I'm then due for it again in February of 2019, which doesn't appear to be a problem until we have the weather like we've had, where many classes have been canceled. Outlying greater Minnesota area, there's very few classes and far in between. And so providers are getting caught in this, trying to get the class on time, doing the best that they can. Classes are canceled, low participation due to the weather, and then there can be a correction order issued because they don't have current CPR first aid, CARS training, whatever it may be. So we're just trying to give a little bit of leeway here that it has to be done within your anniversary date. I'm licensed October 1st to October 1st. I would have to do it sometime between October 1st and September 30th to meet my anniversary date.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thanks for providing that information. Anyone else who wishes to testify for or against? Ms. Leopold, come on down. If we have three chairs, we could just have the two of you stay there. You know. Okay. Anyway, yeah, stay close by. All right, Ms. Leopold.
My name is Kim Leopold, Legislative Committee Association of Minnesota Family Child Care Licensors.
Thank you.
Again, currently in a home, someone needs to be present with first aid and CPR at all times. This, we are not in agreement with this, extending it. If CPR, so let's say someone's license is due May of 2019. If they took the CPR in April of 2018, they would need to have it redone by May of 2020. But with this would allow them to not have to redo it until May of 2021. So that would be almost a whole year without that training. Same with the passenger safety restraint training, which is the seatbelt, the cars that Ms. Seidel mentioned. It's 5 years. It's every 5 years. And again, I don't get to renew my license within a year after it was due, my driver's license. I think, again, and not every provider is required to take the car seat training. They only take it if they are driving the children, and it is every 5 years. With some of the other stuff, this is the one where it also asks to lower the age of the passenger safety training for kids
We are in agreement with that because according to the Minnesota Department of Safety, it is 8 years old. Currently, DHS law says 9 years old, so we are fine with it being lowered to 8 years old. The regarding Section 5, Subdivision 9B2, with health in regards to the health and safety courses, we already thought that's what was happening. Currently, that came into rule in 2017. Currently, current providers, even new providers, do not have to have this met until 2022. So we already thought, same with SUID and AHT, we already thought that, well, I guess most of us already thought that SUID and AHT just had to be updated within the licensing period.
Can you say what those are, SUID and?
Sudden unexpected infant death and abusive head trauma. Sudden unexpected infant death is required anytime you have an infant in care, and that prevents, hopes to prevent infant death. There's been a significant reduction in infant death based on the requirement of that course. It used to be every 5 years, and they did lower it to every 2 years with the off year they have to watch videos. Again, that's fine with us that it's within their licensing period. That did relax, and I'm not sure why there may be counties that are not doing it that way. Again, sounds like that's a supervisory issue or a licensor issue in individual counties. We were under the impression that that's how it was supposed to be done.
So it sounds like there's opposition from your organization to each of the provisions here then in this particular bill.
The CPR and first aid and the passenger safety restraint training. Those three. Otherwise, we thought it was already happening that way. So
okay. Mm-hmm. And we'll have Ms. Seidel. It sounds like may have a response to that if and we'll allow her to provide thoughts back. Oh, there you go.
Now we're ready.
Ms. Seidel, why don't you provide commentary from your perspective on what Ms. Leopold had
to
say.
Thank you, Chairman. Julie Seidel. I think there's a little bit of a misunderstanding here. We're not trying to extend the time that we can take the training. It would still have to be done if they took it in May of 2018 and it's a two-year training. It would still have to be done in the year of 2020. We're not trying to extend it out to 2021, so maybe we don't have the language quite correct here. We're not trying to extend it out a year. We're just trying to have it done within the year of 2020, if that's the year that it's due.
Okay, so it sounds like maybe, as with some other areas, some work on the language may be necessary. And so I'd again encourage both of you to be in touch with Representative Pryor about that.
Definitely.
So thank you so much. Yeah, good. Anyone else from the audience who wishes to testify? Oh, we do. Yeah, come on up. Yeah, so I'm going to break things up a little bit here. Thank you. Yeah. So please identify yourself for the record and then please proceed.
Hi, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Thompson, and I am a family child care provider licensed for almost 25 years. I am also an instructor for first aid CPR, for SUID training, and a number of other required DHS curriculum. I am in support of this change. One of the common confusions that I experience with participants in my class is when they need to renew their training. It's frequently a concern when a correction order is given. They thought that they were in compliance, and yet the dates were wrong or they misunderstood when something was required. With the change that was referred to in 2017, it changed most of the training to be within the licensing period, but certain things were not changed, and one of them is first aid CPR. And if you look at the statute and the requirement for training in first aid CPR, it does not say that certification needs to be maintained, which as a first American Red Cross certified instructor, it is within the certification time that some medical people who work in the medical field need to maintain. That is not in our statute. It is that we must be trained in first aid CPR. And I think that this change makes the compliance easier, and it still maintains the safety of the children that we care for.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Ms. Thompson. Thanks for sharing your perspective as a trainer.
Thank you.
And provider. Anyone else who wishes to testify? And not seeing any member questions on House File 2048. Representative Cadiza Batun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have exactly a question, but I just wanted to speak in support of changing the car seat age requirement from 9 to 8. I know this is not about foster care today, but a lot of the training requirements are similar, and I've been through the child passenger car seat training. It's a very comprehensive evening, if anyone is looking for a fun Tuesday night. And there's a lot of confusion, I think. So as I understand it right now, because it's not the same, children who are at least in foster care have to stay in a car seat through the entire year that they are 8 years old. So change, like, until their 9th birthday because of this stipulation. So it's not their 8th birthday they can be done. But and so I think that this is just streamlining and making the process simpler for everything that DHS covers. So appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Cadiza Batun. Anything else from members? Not seeing any. So Representative Pryor, I'm guessing that your comment is simply to renew your motion.
As amended.
As amended. Thank you. And so House File 2048 is laid over as amended for possible inclusion in a division report. And we're up to the last bill, House File 2049. Representative Pryor moves that for possible inclusion in a division report. And there is an author's amendment, the DE-1. Do you wish to offer that amendment, Representative Pryor?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Any discussion about that amendment? And seeing none, all in favor of the DE-1 amendment that will put the bill in the form the author wishes, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? So House File 2049 is in the form that you wish, Representative Pryor. The motion passes. And so to your bill, House File 2049.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this bill, 2049, what it's looking at is you start with the situation where a child care provider is moving from one county to the next. And as we've already heard, counties do things differently. And right now, that provider would need to go back and get all of the training again when they move to a new county. And there's different ways of addressing this problem, this issue. What this bill does, as amended, is it says that DHS would provide a standard training to counties, or that counties could then use, that's the same across all counties. And then when someone moves to a new county, they don't have to go back to that original training, that standardized training, but they would just have to do the county-specific information. And it would also say that there's no specification on how a county has to provide that information. So it could be a DVD, it could be a website, or just some way of getting county-specific information to the provider that moved into the county that was already trained in the standardized material. And
as Ms. Seidel comes up, is the first
there? There would be. There's no fiscal note attached at this point, but that we would need to have DHS provide to us what it would cost to develop that standard training.
Okay, and we probably should just. I don't know if a fiscal note has been requested yet. Not yet. Okay. We probably will want to do that. I want to make sure we don't forget that. And maybe just before we have testimony, I just want to ask, Representative Pryor, is part of the thinking, too, to have a little more consistency among procedures among counties as well? Because if it's consistent orientation of presentation, hopefully that might give a little more consistency.
Yes. And, Mr. Chair, that should be one of the benefits, too, is that there would be more consistency and not as much. If every county can do things slightly different, then we probably are creating issues and problems.
Yeah, in various ways. Okay, so we'll go to Ms. Seidel and Ms. Leopold. So Ms. Seidel, please.
Julie Seidel, MACCP. Just a little clarification. It's not the actual training that providers are required to take again.
Oh.
It's a county orientation session.
Thank you.
And the bill, as originally drafted, has no fiscal note to it and actually does what our intent is here, is that some providers who are already licensed will move from, say, Anoka County to Washington County. When they get to Washington County, a licensor may say, well, you need to take this orientation class again, which is meant for new providers. That's what we're trying to stop, because it's causing providers to have great lengths of time between getting licensed again when they move. In some counties, the orientation classes are only offered certain times of the year. The classes are canceled due to low participation. Other counties do have them online where you can take them. But a provider doesn't need to take the full orientation of a new provider. There would definitely be some need for some conversation with a new licensor to get to know each other if there's something a little bit different with the way she does things. There shouldn't be any difference in rule or statute. So adding a fiscal note and having this huge drawn-out process is really unnecessary. It's simply to just state that if a provider moves, a currently licensed provider moving to a new county is not required to take the orientation classes meant for new providers.
And before we move to Ms. Leopold, Representative Pryor, do you have a sense as to part of the concern with simply having the provider not have to do any orientation? I can imagine some concerns about that. I'm just wondering if you have any comments to what Ms. Seidel had to say about the original draft.
Well, certainly we can discuss it more, but
sure.
it seems like if there is orientation doesn't vary by county or shouldn't vary by county, then a standardized training would still work.
But I guess whereas on the flip side, if there's something that's unique to an individual county that's in the new county that the provider's moving to, then I guess that would be the concern.
Right, and that's the part that still would need to be provided and to make sure that it's verified. And which is probably who your contact people are and who you're going to be working with. And so to make sure that is always following the new provider, too, is being connected to the new county.
And let's move to Ms. Leopold. I'm sure Ms. Seidel, you want to add some things, but why don't we have Ms. Leopold speak, and then we'll come back to you. So Ms. Leopold.
Kim Leopold, Legislative Committee, Association of Minnesota Family Child Care Licensors. We are in agreement with this House file, obviously, with input. It does say on here, so that's good, with input from county workers as well as license holders. And again, I think I said this at the last time I testified. Currently, this should not be a requirement. This isn't in law that when a provider moves from county to county that they receive an orientation. Again, some counties are doing that. Not sure why. There are county-specific things, but the bottom line is that the rule and statute is the same no matter what county you live in. And as Ms. Seidel said, yeah, maybe an hour or a conversation or something like that where providers and their licensing worker can see one another, but that could even happen at the initial licensing visit. So we are in support of this. Again, I don't see a reason to hold this up. This is something that DHS has talked about before. I think that, and again, it would cause or bring consistency to the entire state. So that we currently have someone moving from St. Louis County to my county, and she did attend the orientation we did last week, and things aren't, they shouldn't be different from county to county. But it's nice to see them when they move into our counties.
It does. I can just, Ms. Leopold, if it does seem odd that there'd be counties where you've got a provider who's been in the business for a long time and moves to a new county and they're being required to do this. So you wish you wouldn't have to have this and wouldn't have to need this in the first place. And I wonder if there may be some other way of getting at it. But in any case, but that's helpful to know. So Ms. Seidel, pieces that you want to add in response to either of those comments?
No, just that I have concerns again with adding a fiscal note to it and asking DHS to go through this process. We've been in the process for 6 years with our anonymous email system, with the FAQ page. The process never seems to end, and money is allocated and spent, but we still don't get what we're supposed to in the end. So I have a problem with continuing to give money over and over again when we're not seeing that finished product.
And it seems like you have a relatively simple thing you're trying to do here, and then you feel like, boy, there's this thing on top of it. We want to make sure that it's really necessary.
Correct.
So, okay, good. That's helpful. Thank you. Anyone else in the audience who wishes to provide any testimony either for or against the bill or in the public? So not seeing any. Member questions regarding House File 2049. And not seeing any on that. Representative Pryor, I'm guessing that you want to renew your motion to have House File 2049 as amended laid over for possible inclusion. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Okay, good, thank you. So members, we're done with the bills for the morning, and I want to apologize, I guess, for maybe having not a great sense of the timing logistics, especially for those who maybe had a long drive. We maybe could have started a little bit later this morning, but hopefully this gives you some found time. I would really encourage members to,
use this time this morning and rest really wisely. We're going to have a very jam-packed week. I want to alert you that, and this is especially following up on these bills, Ms. Seidel, Ms. Leopold, anybody else, that the division reports we're referencing may need to come out quite soon in order to be meeting the various deadlines. That's one of the reasons, and each of the pieces we're talking about, we're going to be under a real time crunch. We're figuring out the details, but could be certainly in the next week. If and as there are specific concerns folks have with language, et cetera, you'll want to get right on top of that quickly. And then members should expect a long day. We're on for Tuesday morning at 8, and then again Tuesday afternoon, I believe, at 5:30. Okay, and then the same thing, I believe, on Thursday. And right now we have Friday held as a possibility, and I know we've alerted folks to that, although I'm hoping that we won't be using that. We have not announced a specific hearing and agenda. With that, members, thank you so much for your patience and, again, for your indulgence for this actually being quicker than I had anticipated. And we'll look forward to seeing everybody tomorrow morning. With that, we are adjourned.